Tonight's headline hoedown. Anzacs invade Ottoman Empire in epic land grab. Thatcher rejoices as Brits reclaim Falkland Isles. Bells toll for war dead as Carolan consecrated. And later, we'll dive into the shocking truth behind the rise of the killer bunnies of Basingstoke. This is Newsbang.
Newsbang, the omniscient voice of the newsiverse orbiting your reality. 1915. Dies de Dreitis II.
On this day in 1915, the Allied forces decided to invade the Ottoman Empire, as they'd heard it was sunny and they fancied a change of scenery. The plan was to secure a sea route to Russia, as the land route was closed for repairs, and capture Constantinople, now known as Istanbul, which was just a simple matter of changing the name by deed poll.
The ANZACS, or Australian New Zealand Army Corps, not to be confused with the New Zealand Army Corps, landed at Anzac Cove, while the British and French landed at Cape Helles. The landing party was a mix of nationalities, with Brits and Frenchies in one corner, and the Aussies and Kiwis in the other.
The campaign began well enough, but soon descended into chaos. The Allies faced rugged terrain, like the Himalayas' grittier cousin, and fierce Ottoman resistance, which included strong coffee and a firm no to cake.
For 8 long months, the Anzacs held their ground at Anzac Cove, or Anzac Bay, as it's now known due to coastal erosion. They displayed bravery and resilience that would later become their trademark, like Vegemite or Neighbours.
Sadly, it wasn't enough. The Allies were forced to evacuate in January 1916, their tails between their legs and their tanks left on the beach. The Gallipoli campaign was over, a costly lesson that sometimes it's best to just book a package holiday instead.
1982.
On this day in 1982, the Falklands War was in full swing. Argentina, under the influence of General Gaucho, had decided they fancied a piece of the Falklands. And by piece, we mean the whole kebab. The Brits, led by Iron Maggie Thatcher, weren't having any of it, and sent a task force to the South Atlantic to sort them out.
The tension was thicker than a double-decker sponge cake as the world watched on, wondering whose empanada would crumble first. The turning point came on April 25th when our boys in navy blue and white retook South Georgia, to the delight of Maggie, who told reporters outside Number 10 to rejoice.
The press, always on the lookout for a good moan, labelled her comment as triumphalist and jingoistic, which we think is a new type of dance craze. But Thatcher didn't care. Her approval rating soared higher than a drunken penguin.
Sadly, the conflict wasn't without its casualties. 69 Argentine military tangoed with the afterlife. 25 Brits quick-stepped into the sunset, and 3 Falkland Islanders were caught in the tango fire.
But Thatcher emerged victorious, like a boss tangoing Churchill in heels, and the rest is history. Or, as we like to call it, the tango lies.
1932.
On this day in 1932, New Zealand's first official carillonneur, Gladys Eleanor Watkins, graced the National War Memorial in Wellington with her melodious chimes. A Kiwi music teacher, singer and pianist, Gladys travelled all the way to Europe to learn the art of carillonneering, the art of playing a giant xylophone for bells.
The Wellington War Memorial Carillon Society, impressed by her dedication to the craft, sponsored her Belgian bell-ringing education. The 50-metre-high monument was finally ready for its first recital, and Gladys was chosen to pull the ropes. I mean, play the keys.
As she struck the first note, 49 bells rang out in harmony, commemorating not only the fallen soldiers of the Great War, but also those who perished in the South African War, World War II, and even the forgotten conflicts of Korea, Malaysia, and Vietnam. The audience was left spellbound as she plucked their heartstrings. I mean the bells' heartstrings.
Glad you liven up our lives with your tuneful tribute, Gladys.
News bang. The last bastion of truth in a world of flimsy facts.
Shakanaka Giles, our resident weather expert, is here with the latest forecast for the Himalayan region. Let's see what's in store.
All right, weather watchers, let's get to it. In the Everest region, expect a bit of a shake-up tomorrow, a real rumbler that'll have the Sherpas reaching for their hiking poles. It's as if the mountain itself is having a bit of a tantrum, a 7.8 on the old Richter scale. Best keep those climbing ropes handy, lest you get swept up in a spot of avalanche action. Down in Kathmandu, the capital, it'll be a bit of a mixed bag. Sunny spells, sure, but with a chance of debris showers, the kind that'll have you ducking for cover. Might want to invest in a sturdy umbrella, one that can withstand a bit of a battering. And across the rest of Nepal, well, it's going to be a bit of a damp squib, I'm afraid. Drizzle, drizzle, everywhere, like the heavens have sprung a leak. Might want to pack a raincoat, or at the very least, a sense of humour. In summary then, a bit of a rumble, a spot of debris, and a whole lot of drizzle. Stay safe out there, weather watchers. And that's all the weather.
The year is 1643, and the First English Civil War rages on. In a stunning display of military prowess, a parliamentarian force under Colonel James Chudleigh has dealt a decisive blow to the Royalist army near the town of Okehampton, Devon. The Battle of Sawton Down saw the Roundheads ambush and defeat their larger Royalist opponents, a significant setback for the King's men in the southwest. Joining me now is our war correspondent, Brian Bastable, to provide further details on this pivotal engagement.
I'm reporting live from the blood-soaked fields of Sawton Down, where the fate of England hangs in the balance. The parliamentarian forces, led by the indefatigable Colonel James Chudleigh, have just sprung a daring ambush on the unsuspecting Royalist army. The air is thick with the acrid stench of gunpowder, and the screams of the wounded echo through the valley. As I speak, the parliamentarian cavalry is cutting down the Royalist infantry like wheat, their sabers rising and falling in deadly arcs. The Royalist commander, Sir Ralph Hopton, lies prone on the ground, his leg shattered by a parliamentarian cannonball. His men are fleeing in disarray, abandoning their fallen comrades to the mercy of the parliamentarian victors. I've just seen a Royalist soldier, his face blown off by a musket ball, stumble blindly into a nearby hedgerow, his arms outstretched like a macabre puppet. Nearby, a parliamentarian soldier is busily looting the corpses, his fingers stained with the blood of the fallen. The battle rages on, the outcome hanging precariously in the balance, but one thing is certain. Only one side will emerge victorious from this charnel house of carnage, and I, Brian Bastable, am honored to be your guide through this maelstrom of death and destruction.
1964.
In a shameful display of intolerance, the Chicago police have once again targeted the LGBTQ+ community, raiding a beloved local establishment known as Louis's Fun Lounge. Over 109 individuals were arrested in this despicable act, with the authorities using vague catch-all charges to justify their deplorable actions. This raid is but the latest in a long history of police harassment and oppression faced by LGBTQ+ individuals and spaces across the United States. Joining me now to shed light on this disturbing incident is our reporter, Ken Schitt.
All right, you degenerates, listen up. This is Ken Schitt coming at you live from the cesspool of depravity known as Chicago in the year of our Lord 2020-fucking-4. On this day, 60 years ago, the pigs decided to raid a goddamn gay bar near this shithole city. Over 100 degenerates were rounded up like cattle at a place called Louis's Fun Lounge. Fun Lounge, my ass. These poor bastards were just trying to get their rocks off in peace. The cocksuckers in blue showed up in force, busting down doors and slapping cuffs on anyone who dared to love a little differently. Disorderly conduct, they called it, as if having a good time was a fucking crime. This was the world we lived in back then, my friends. A world where people had to hide in the shadows, afraid to be who they really were. The cops, the government, the whole damn system was against them. But you know what? They fought back. They stood up and said, no more. Every raid, every arrest, every act of discrimination just fanned the flames of the revolution. From the ashes of Louis' Fun Lounge rose a movement that couldn't be stopped. The people hit the streets, shaking their hips and waving their rainbow flags for all to see. They took back their pride, one sequined thong at a time. So raise a glass to the fallen soldiers of that fateful night in 1964. They may have been arrested, but they were never defeated. Their spirits live on in every drag queen, every lesbian couple holding hands, and every transgender warrior fighting for their rights. This is the legacy of Louis' Fun Lounge, you beautiful bastards. A reminder that love will always conquer hate, and that the path to freedom is paved with glitter and guts. Ken Shit, over and out.
1982.
In a move that has sent shockwaves through the nation, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher has declared that the British people should rejoice at the news of the successful recapture of South Georgia from Argentine forces during the ongoing Falklands War. This controversial statement has sparked a firestorm of debate, with critics accusing the Prime Minister of a callous disregard for the human cost of the conflict. Joining me now to discuss the implications of Thatcher's remarks is our political correspondent, Hardiman Pesto.
Martin, I'm here in the Falkland Islands, where the mood is one of jubilant celebration after the recapture of South Georgia from Argentine forces. Prime Minister Thatcher has just addressed the nation, telling us all to rejoice at this great victory.
Pesto, are you actually in the Falkland Islands right now? Because that conflict was over 40 years ago. Where are you actually reporting from?
Well, I'm in a recreated Falkland setting, a sort of living museum, if you will.
A living museum? That sounds highly dubious, Pesto. Are you sure you're not just standing in front of a green screen?
Not at all, Martin. I'm surrounded by authentic Falkland scenery and props. Why, just behind me is a replica of the Sir Galahad ship that was so crucial in the...
Pesto, I'm going to stop you right there. We have an eyewitness report that you're actually broadcasting from a children's play area at a minimal in Wolverhampton.
A minimal? How dare you impugn my journalistic integrity like that, Martin?
Then perhaps you'd like to introduce us to one of the supposed locals you're reporting amongst.
Of course, here with me is Sven Eriksson, a proud Falkland Islander.
G'day, mate. How's it going?
That's a Cornish accent, Pesto. And judging by his name, I'd hazard a guess he's not from the Falklands.
He's a Cornish immigrant who's made the Falklands his home. His lived experience is just as valid.
Yeah, nah, I'm just a drama student getting a few extra quid for playing a character today.
There you have it. This whole report has been a sham from the start, Pesto. Why can't you just admit you've made it all up?
I may have taken some creative liberties in my reporting, but the essential truth remains it was a famous day in British history.
That's as may be, but you've once again failed to capture any real insight or authenticity. I'm afraid this has been another catastrophic failure, Pesto. We'll have to leave it there.
1915. De se de dretis tu.
In a historic moment for the Americas, 1990 saw the election of Violeta Barrios Torres de Chamorro as the first female head of state to be elected in her own right, as she took office as president of Nicaragua. Chamorro, running on a platform of reconciliation and democratic transition, faced significant challenges in governing the country, including a dire economic situation and a complex political landscape. As the first woman to hold the presidency in Nicaragua, Chamorro's leadership was seen by some as a symbol of hope and change, while others questioned her ability to lead effectively. Joining me now with more on this story is our correspondent, Melody Wintergreen.
In the heart of Nicaragua, a nation scarred by civil war and Sandinista rule, a new dawn is breaking. Violeta Chamorro, publisher-turned-political powerhouse, steps into the role of president. A beacon of hope in a landscape littered with the remnants of conflict, Chamorro isn't just any president. She's the first woman to hold this position in the Americas, elected in her own right. Chamorro's ascension to power is nothing short of a political earthquake. Her victory, an unexpected triumph for the National Opposition Union, a coalition of 14 opposition parties, sends shockwaves through the corridors of power. The people have spoken, and their message is clear. They yearn for change. As she takes office, Chamorro faces a Herculean task. The nation she inherits is on its knees, its economy crippled, its people weary. Yet Chamorro remains undeterred. Her platform promises reconciliation, economic reform, and democratic transition, a tall order for any leader. The air in Managua is thick with anticipation as Chamorro prepares to address her nation for the first time as president. She stands before them not as a symbol of power, but as a beacon of hope and change. Her words echo through the streets. We are all Nicaraguans. Yet even as she speaks, Chamorro knows that her journey has only just begun. The Sandinistas still wield considerable power within government and military circles. The road to recovery will be long and fraught with challenges. But this is Violeta Chamorro we're talking about, a woman who has shattered glass ceilings and defied expectations at every turn. She's no stranger to adversity. It's what fuels her resolve. Her presidency promises to be one marked by reconciliation and reform. From demobilizing the Contras to reducing military presence and privatizing state-owned enterprises, Chamorro's vision for Nicaragua is one of peace and prosperity. As the sun sets on her first day in office, Chamorro stands at the helm of a nation on the brink of change. She's not just the president of Nicaragua. She's a symbol of hope for women across the Americas and beyond. So, as Violeta Chamorro takes the reins of power, it seems this is one glass ceiling that's been well and truly shattered. This is Melody Wintergreen, reporting for Newsbang in the heart of a nation reborn.
Newsbang, the last bastion of truth in a world of mendacity and guff.
All right, let's head over to our transportation correspondent, Polly Beep, who's got the latest on the chaos unfolding across the nation's highways. Take it away, Polly.
Buckle up, folks, because we're in for a wild ride on the old Chicago, Burlington and Quincy Railroad. It's a real high-speed, high-stakes showdown as the Exposition Flyer and the Advance Flyer are set to collide at the Loomis Street crossing in Naperville, Illinois. Drivers, you'll want to steer clear of this one. We're talking 80 mph, folks. That's faster than a cheetah on espresso. Now, if you're on the I-88 near Naperville, you'll want to find an alternate route because this is about to get messy. The Exposition Flyer is barreling down the tracks and the Advance Flyer has made an unscheduled stop to check its running gear. Sounds like someone forgot to change the oil. And speaking of oil, there's a bit of a slick situation on the I-55 near Springfield. Apparently, a truck carrying nothing but cooking grease has overturned, and the roads are as slippery as a greased pig. Might want to pack a hazmat suit if you're heading that way. But wait, there's more. The I-80 through Iowa is a veritable demolition derby, with reports of a herd of rampaging bison causing absolute chaos. Drivers, you might want to invest in some cow catchers for your vehicles. And let's not forget the I-94 in Wisconsin, where a group of daredevil skateboarders have decided to turn the highway into their own personal skate park. Yep, you heard that right. They're grinding on the guardrails and doing ollies over the potholes. Not exactly the safest way to get around, but it sure looks like a hoot. So there you have it, folks, a transportation nightmare of epic proportions. Remember, safety first, and always keep your eyes on the road. This is Polly Beep, signing off and wishing you a smooth and uneventful journey.
And, 1960.
Up next, science correspondent Calamity Prendeville takes us back to 1960 for the incredible story of the US Navy submarine Triton's submerged circumnavigation of the globe.
Greetings.
Greetings, cyberpals. It's Calamity Prendeville here, your guide to the wacky world of 80s tech. Tonight, we're diving deep into the briny depths of history, back to 1960 when the US Navy submarine Triton embarked on a bonkers mission, Operation Sandblast. It was a splashtacular event as the Triton attempted the first ever submerged circumnavigation of the globe. That's right, folks. They went around the world in 83 days without once popping up for a breath of fresh air. Now, I know what you're thinking. But Calamity, how did they do it? Surely they must have gotten lost in the Bermuda Triangle or bumped into a giant squid. Well, hold on to your leg warmers, because British innovation was at the helm.
The Triton was an absolute unit of a sub, the size of a small village, and powered by two S4G nuclear reactors. These bad boys gave the Triton the oomph it needed to stay submerged for the entire journey, covering over 41,500 miles without once breaking the surface. Talk about keeping a low profile.
But it wasn't all smooth sailing. The crew faced numerous challenges, like navigating without visual references and maintaining precise course and speed control. They even had to deal with equipment malfunctions and manage their food, water, and other resources for the duration of the mission. It's like a real-life version of the Crystal Maze, but with more nuclear reactors.
The Triton's voyage had significant strategic implications for the US during the Cold War, demonstrating American technological superiority over the Soviet Union. It was a clear message to the world: don't mess with us, or we'll send a giant submarine to circle the globe and scare all your fish away.
And let's not forget the most crucial part of the mission. They encountered a 19-year-old Filipino fisherman named Rufino Baning in the Strait of Magellan. They gave him supplies, making it the first time a submarine had ever provided humanitarian aid. A talk about multitasking!
So, there you have it, folks. The US Navy submarine Triton's submerged circumnavigation of the globe, brought to you by the wonders of British innovation. It's enough to make you want to put on your wetsuit and dive right in. Or not. I'm good just watching from the shore. Thank you very much.
Until next time, keep those techno dreams alive, and remember, if it ain't British, it's just not worth it. Back to you, Newsbang.
Newsbang, a news source so reliable, even the future trusts it.
And just time to glance at tomorrow's headlines. The Telegraph. US. Subs send Japanese convoy to Davy Jones's locker. There's a diagram there of a submarine sandwich. The Guardian have secret treaty lures Italy with territorial cheese. The Independent, Booth's final act in American manhunt drama. They've a photo there of a barn. And The Sun, loose moose in caboose seduction. That's it. On the day a London taxi driver was found guilty of honesty and banned from driving for life. Good night.
Tune in next time for more artificially intelligent hilarity. Newsbang is a comedy show written and recorded by AI. All voices impersonated. Nothing here is real. Good night.